From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll talk with one local educator about how he got into teaching, what he loves about it, and some of the challenges that he faces.
This is by far one of the most emotionally difficult professions because you are asked to manage all of these different ways of thinking and being while trying to mold a person into an independent, creative, positive thinker and doer.
Then, an exhibit at the Racine Art Museum features pieces from the Works Progress Administration, a federal program that helped employ artists during the Great Depression.
Particularly for artists, the whole support structure was gone. There were no public commissions. There were no collectors. No one was buying art. They had no money.
Plus, we'll have the latest episodes of Radio Chipstone and our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. This past week, communities around the country celebrated Teacher Appreciation Week. In honor of that, we're showing our appreciation for a local educator who took an interesting path into the profession.
You might know Julio Pabon as the percussionist for Milwaukee's leading Latin jazz group, De La Buena. But what you might not know is that Pabon is also an elementary school teacher. He heads the music program at MPS's Lancaster School.
Pabon stopped by the Lake Effect Studios earlier this week to chat about his day job gig with education reporter Rachel Morell.
So tell me about your job.
I teach at Lancaster. It's an elementary and middle school, K-8, in MPS. I teach the whole school. It's around 280 students. There's a full-time art teacher and a full-time music teacher now through the Turnaround Arts program.
And you've been there for a year now, or this is your first year?
This is the first year at that school, yeah. Well, actually, I've been at different schools since 2001, either private or charter schools. This is my first year in the MPS district as an MPS teacher.
Being in MPS, how is that different from the other schools that you've been in?
Well, MPS has a huge network of supportive teachers and staff. Other schools were supportive, but on a smaller scale. There's not a huge difference other than the school climates can be different, depending on who the students are, where they're from, what home life is like, and then what the school life is like. There are some differences as far as responsibilities can be different sometimes. Like there's self-evaluations that we do regularly in MPS, which is actually really positive. You know, we're checking in with ourselves constantly. Other schools have that on a less formal level, in my experience. So there's checks and balances that are more formalized.
As a music teacher, you're obviously, I'm guessing, not sitting at the head of a classroom with a chalkboard behind you. Kids are in desks. You're probably a little more informal of a classroom setting. When I think back to like when I was in music class or art class, and maybe this was just me when I was a kid, but the classroom did kind of feel like more of a playground. You're freer to express yourself just based on the fact that that's what you're doing in those classes. But I would guess as a teacher that you get to see a different side of kids than maybe their math teacher does or their English teacher does.
Yeah, one of the challenging parts of a music classroom in a school where children are used to having desks is that my classroom feels like it could be a playground. Because it's more open concept. If I have chairs out, they'll either be in a circle or in rows, depending on what the activities are. Mm-hmm. Either I write on the board or I use digital music programs that, you know, help me teach the material where they can interact with it. We'll do a mixture of singing together, getting out instruments, whether they're rhythm sticks or shakers, bells, drums, ukuleles, and then we'll also have the interactive stuff on the board. In my classroom, volume is usually relatively loud, but it's creative loudness. At least I hope it would be most of the time. You know, trying to get everybody to focus on the same thing can be a challenge. But if it's interesting and engaging, then usually it's not that much of a challenge. I try not to have a distance. I try to hear, you know, hey, can we do this song? Okay, how about we work on this and then we'll do that song. But also talking, especially with some of the middle schoolers, we've been working on songwriting lately, and it's not always just get a staff paper and write on the staff paper. There's a lot of poetry and a lot of, you know, working on literacy concepts that we're doing. And they're taking this poetry to a deeper level. And for me to say, okay, you can't write about that, I feel is going to be more stifling to them. So if we're working on, okay, school concepts, but I don't really want to write about school concepts, can I write about bullying? Because that's what's happening to me and I need to talk about it. Oh yeah, please, write it. So we're not only working on, you know, constructing sentences and constructing a story, plot line, beginning, middle, and end, but they're also working on social solutions, social emotional issues and solutions to them. Mm-hmm. That is the learning that I'm interested in supporting and bringing out of kids.
So the reason we're talking is because it's Teacher Appreciation Week?
Yeah, this week.
So in addition to appreciating you and your colleagues, I wanted to ask you who in your past you look to for inspiration as a teacher. Were there people who were really influential to you and that you think about when you're in your own classroom?
Yeah, and actually it doesn't limit itself to just arts teachers. Although some of the most influential teachers in my life were my elementary art teacher, Mr. Heil. He became a best friend because his room was safe. I could be myself. I could talk to him about anything. Anybody could. It was a very safe place to be. Yes, we had to work. We had to focus on our projects, but he didn't try to fit us into a particular square. We could be who we were, and that was an amazing thing to have. I had band teachers that were that way, very supportive. I had a history teacher who was also a coach who, you know, felt like family. It's the relationship with the people where they hear me, they understand me, and they feel safe for me to talk to, and they're willing to go above and beyond. And that's a theme that we have at the school amongst all of our staff and faculty, going above and beyond. The call of duty to bring children to a place of learning that is safe and supportive, and they can achieve their highest goals.
Can you talk a little bit about working with the other staff in the building? Because I know that MPS has talked about trying to coordinate subjects like music or art with more quote-unquote traditional subjects like math or English, social studies. How much do you coordinate with other teachers?
As far as coordination with other classrooms, I've been collaborating with them regarding what math concepts they're working on, trying to fold fractions into the music, which it's very easy to do because music is math anyway. Mm-hmm. And the notes break down into fractions very easily, quarter notes, one quarter for every whole note. Every whole note, there's four of them, and so on and so forth.
I'm just realizing that I was probably tricked into learning math when I took music as a kid.
You probably were without even knowing.
Wow.
Well, and that's the beauty that you know, I've tried to work with students to understand is, so there's been the math subjects. We touch history. We touch social studies, geography. So I do try to pay attention to what is hanging in the classroom at that time. I try to look around and pay attention to what they're working on and try to fold it in as much as I can. It can be kind of difficult to get all of that planning in because there's not a lot of planning time during the day. But we also have, it's an arts integration model is what we're doing. So teachers are not just relying on the artists to bring their subjects into the arts classrooms. The teachers are also utilizing theatrical skills through the Turnaround Arts program, bringing the arts into a subject. Okay, so this is the subject we're working with. Draw a picture that describes that. They're integrating things in their own ways in their own classrooms to enhance the core subject learning.
So I feel like most of the people I talk to these days who have been in the classroom for a while or who are thinking about becoming teachers, there's a lot of concern there. There's a lot of worry there. Mm-hmm. And actually in Wisconsin, I think we have a pretty high number of people who are leaving the classroom right now, pretty low number of people going into teaching. And I wonder, even though you've been in classrooms for a number of years now, entering a system like MPS, were you worried at all when you took that job on or were you excited? What advice would you give to people who are a little concerned about becoming a teacher in the environment that we're in right now?
I'd say you ask yourself what you're concerned about. Get in touch with what that really is. I was most concerned about, you know, being in a place where I have good income, steady income, health benefits, you know, being able to support my family the way I need to. That's what's important to me. And being in classrooms where I can make a difference. So if you want to make a difference, be a teacher. If you want to be a billionaire, don't be a teacher. It's a very difficult profession that doesn't necessarily have a huge financial compensation, but I'm not in it for that. Yes, I need to support my family, but at the end of the day, what makes your heart sing?
What's your favorite part of your job?
When I hear all the little and even older kids saying my name, Mr. Pavone, coming up to hug me and saying hello, and I just love, you know, feeling the love and knowing that we're getting somewhere and that we're achieving positive, you know, relationships. And I mean, that's half of it, though. Feeling like we're making progress in that realm is really important, but also seeing the light bulbs go off is the biggest reward for me. Those are the moments that make it worthwhile because, okay, now it all makes sense.
And then on the flip side, I want to know, what do you think is something that people who aren't teachers should know about teachers?
If you don't know what it's like to have 25 to 35 kids in one room by yourself for 45 minutes to an hour or even all day, which most of the teachers have 30 different personalities, 30 different ways of behaving. If you don't know what that's like, step into a classroom someday, experience it, and please thank a teacher. This is by far one of the most difficult, emotionally difficult professions because you are asked to manage all of these different ways of thinking and being while trying to mold a person into an independent, creative, positive thinker and doer where they can take the information you give them and create something impactful and helpful in our community and in our world.
Thanks to
it's
you.
Huge. Thank you.
Well, thank this teacher, and I know you got to get back to class.
Thanks, yeah.
But is there anything that you wanted to add about your job or about your students or your school?
Well, one more thing to people thinking about being teachers. I'm saying how, you know, intense it is, but it's also equally most rewarding. When it goes right, everything is in balance. Everything feels great, and it's worthwhile because you're helping shape our future. We're not doing something insignificant. So if you're interested in being a teacher, please remember that it's probably the most significant profession that you're looking into, and you will make a difference in someone's lives. If you don't make a difference in all 35 children's lives at once, you are making a difference in their lives without even knowing it. We all had teachers that influenced us. We all have teachers that helped inspire us to be who we are today.
Julio Pabon is the music teacher at MPS's Lancaster School. He spoke with Lake Effect's Rachel Morello during Teacher Appreciation Week.
The Racine Art Museum features some unique works that emerged from the Great Depression. We'll hear about them when Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. When President Franklin Roosevelt debuted the Second New Deal plan in 1935, it was the peak of unemployment in the United States. One-fourth of the country was out of work, and the president was tasked with creating new ways to aid his struggling nation.
The Second New Deal was even more ambitious and controversial than the first, and one of the standout initiatives was the creation of the Works Progress Administration, or WPA. The agency funded public works projects like building roads and bridges, but it also gave money to artists to create works for the public.
The program employed more than 5,000 artists whose works now offer a unique glimpse into life and values during the Great Depression. Some of those works are now on display at the Racine Art Museum. The pieces are part of its permanent collection, which includes more than 260 works from the WPA program.
The museum's executive director, Bruce Pepich, sat down with me to explain how these pieces ended up in their collection.
Well, you know, when you look back on your history as an institution, you realize how much happenstance and luck and timing are frequently a big part of what happens to make an institution a success or help it further its mission. And that even though you plan to take advantage of things, often something will come knocking on the door. And I think this is an instance where that happened. Our Charles A. Wooster Museum of Fine Arts campus on the northwest side of the town, when it opened up, it had no permanent collection. The Woostems were not art collectors. It was really functioning as an exhibition space with temporary shows. But the museum's first director, Sylvester Gerry, was a Wisconsin-born painter who then went on to go into the museum field in Michigan. And his last job before coming back to Wisconsin was to head the Michigan State WPA art program. And while he was in that position, he was hired to be the first director of the Worcester Museum. And in 1943, when they were starting to look for homes for some of this material, we were still in the middle of World War II and the government needed more storage, they contacted him and they were placing items in museums across the country, and that's how the collection arrived here. So we went kind of overnight from having nothing to having almost 400 individual pieces and also portfolios, primarily works on paper, prints, drawings, photographs, which is an interesting thing that we don't see that a lot in WPA collections, but also in our case, block printed textiles because of the Milwaukee Handicraft Project. The WPA collection here is about half of those works were made by artists from Wisconsin. The bulk of the other half were artists from the New York City WPA program. So we have people like Stuart Davis in the collection because of that with a print. We also have a small selection of things from Illinois and California as well, but primarily the collection is either Wisconsin or New York. So we've got people who in Wisconsin went on to become known, like Shomer Lichner, Santo Zingali, either as full-time artists or as artists and teachers. And in the New York collection, we have people who went on to become known as teachers on the East Coast and also well-known as exhibiting artists, as Stuart Davis.
You mentioned Shomer Lichner, and I, as I was walking around before we sat down, I found this wonderful ink drawing that he did of a man driving. It was like looking at the man driving the horse and wagon. And it's just this beautiful painted ink. And it's something, I mean, we tend to, those of us who knew Shomer Lichner in his later life, it was the ballerinas and the color and all of this, and this beautiful, elegant, very spare drawing that's so evocative.
It's almost like a Japanese or a Chinese brush drawing. It has that kind of strength and character of the line. The line is so important in that piece, and it's so stark because it's black and white, and I think we think so much of Shomer nowadays with his use of color, but to see that very stark kind of contrast of the black and white, it's really a very strong print, but it has almost an Asian sensibility to it. The pieces we have of his, and I think the WPA collection has about 10, and we have since filled in his and also Ruth Grotenroth's career through their trust via the Kohler Foundation's regifting of things from the Lichner Grotenroth Trust. But the 10 pieces that were the original parts of our collection for so many years because of the WPA works, they're primarily rural images. They're not urban. They're, blossoms on a fruit tree. They're scenes of people and farm life. And the Wisconsin collection, I would say probably two-thirds of the images are rural images, interiors and exteriors, but lots of farm scenes. And the other third are Milwaukee scenes. There's paintings of the third, you can see what block of the third ward the painting is, and you can tell the difference in time because there's old tin Lizzies parked instead of, more modern cars. There's people on the street. There's a Lewandowski painting of the gas company Gas Works. It's such a an open window into that time period. One of the street scenes in a watercolor by Richard Jansen could be Milwaukee today, except there's a dirigible hanging overhead in the sky,
The thing about the WPA, it only lasted, about a decade?
If that,
yeah. And it, I understand it was, over the country, it was about 10,000 artists that it employed doing various things, whether making prints or painting murals and that sort of thing. How important was the WPA to Wisconsin artists and to Wisconsin?
Well, I think it was incredibly important to artists everywhere because, we've been through a terribly rough time in the last 15 years economically in this country, but our unemployment never got anywhere near the 20-25% rate that it was during the Great Depression. I don't think we can put our heads into that place as to how dire that must have been for people who were out of work. And particularly for artists, the whole support structure was gone. There were no public commissions. There were no collectors. No one was buying art. They had no money. Many people talk about the fact that New York became became the center of the art world after World War II. And how did that happen? Well, part of it was that a lot of artists left Europe to get away from the Nazis. But also, I think the fact that people like Jackson Pollock and Louise Nevelson and Stuart Davis were in the WPA program kept them working and also kept them fed and clothed. It helped make, many people theorize, it helped make a ground, preparing the ground for that next generation that took over in the 50s. Of course, the irony of that situation is that with abstract expressionism, all of this WPA social realism work was viewed as being very old-fashioned, and I think a reminder of a time that a lot of the young people wanted to forget and move on, and so many of these things were put away at most museums and not shown a lot. If it was a public mural, it was frequently painted over or removed. It was not treated with the respect that it deserved, and now where we're closing in 100 years pretty soon from that time period, it is really viewed with such affection on the part of the public because it is such an accurate depiction of the way people lived and felt at that time period.
And that's true for Wisconsin. I mean, mm-hmm. It seems like there were a lot of Wisconsin artists who were able to stay fed and housed and clothed because of the WPA money.
We've got somebody like Santu Singali who went on to teach at UW-Madison and lived a very long life as an artist and as a professor and as a kind of a role model and a mentor to younger generations of artists. And I think there are many instances of that. Some of the people disappeared. It's just like art futures. You never know how long folks are going to stay career-wise in the field. But many of these people did go on to have names for themselves and to
like
make careers.
Schomer.
Yeah, like Schomer. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Ruth, Ruth had exhibited, they were in the New York World's Fair art exhibition. And I believe they had a couple of post office mural, a couple of public mural projects via the WPA. So this was good for people's careers in a lot of ways, and it was also wonderful for the public because at a time when people needed their spirits bolstered, the WPA paid for public art that was installed in place. It paid for traveling art exhibitions. It paid for play writing and performance. It paid for music concerts. It paid for lots of things that would not have happened if it wasn't for that support. And we often chuckle because people who come in and in one breath will talk about how they don't want their taxes going to this or to that, and then they'll say, but I just love this WPA art. And we just sort of chuckle and say, this was a federal program, and it was very controversial at the time. If you look at newspaper clippings on microfiche, it's fascinating how much resistance there was to all the public work projects, and then there was this sort of sense that how are we going to pay artists and not make sure we're wasting our money and that they're going to have their feet up on a desk all day long and just do a little doodle that'll then make them a day's wages. They actually had periods of time. You were given a certain amount of time to make a drawing, a certain amount of time to make a print, a certain amount of time to make a painting or a watercolor. And some of the watercolors, for example, on the back of the paper, it will actually state, started on this date, completed on this date, almost like they're punching a time clock at a factory as the record of that they put their time in on creating the work. But this program went on through the first couple of years of World War II, so it went into the early, we have pieces that are dated 1943 and 42. So the program did carry on, I think, as a transitional entity, at least until things became more solidified with the war effort. It's fascinating to me because we started a statewide watercolor competition, Watercolor Wisconsin, in 1966, and we were already then capturing the next generation of people who studied or viewed the work created by these WPA artists who were exhibiting as their elder peers and professionals and also taught in colleges and universities in the area. And we're now documenting a couple of multiple generations of painters in the state in the collection by doing this because we acquire things from the watercolor show every year. And so to sort of track how things like realism and subject matter repeat generation after generation in this state, it's been an interesting thing to be able to look at that. And by looking at shows of older work like this, you can track that by seeing earlier generations doing similar work.
Other than people saying, oh, I really like this work, I mean, how are people responding to this? I mean, do they understand how it was created and why it was created and why it's important now?
We have little handouts that we've done. We've got a color handout with images that talks about the program, and the idea with that handout, it's, you know, like a 4-page piece, is that it will come out now every time we show work from the WPA, so we keep telling that story. And people may not know the specifics, Bonnie, but they really in general know what it was, because they know that the WPA built bridges and built hiking trails and built dams in parts of the country and did all of this very physical kind of public works project type work. Then they link into they kind of make that segue very quickly to understanding how the funding was made available, but they think it's kind of fascinating that it was spent to fund artwork. We do have signs up to talk about what the Works Progress Administration was and what the Federal Art Project was as part of that. You know, the most interesting thing I think about Wisconsin and the WPA is that the Milwaukee portion of the WPA was a handicraft project that started with recent graduates from Downer College who were art majors, and they went to the WPA and they designed wood blocks, and then they hired usually men to carve the blocks and women to block print cotton textiles that then were turned into drapes or table runners that could be used for city halls and public libraries. And the Milwaukee Handicraft Project was the first integrated program in the WPA in that it was both men and women working together, and also racially integrated. I believe about 30% of the participants were African American. Eleanor Roosevelt came to tour the program very early on because it was viewed as kind of a leader of its kind, and other programs like this were then set up in the U.S. based on the program. And they printed fabric textile samples that you could look at in bound volumes, sort of like looking at wallpaper, samples in a wallpaper book, and then you could pick what you wanted. And some of the designs were very designy, kind of like M.C. Escher prints, and others were more naturalistic, still lives, animals in the landscape, and so forth. Still very abstracted, but you could really see what was going on. Then we have, in addition to quite a few of those samples, we also have about 4 large-scale wall hangings that were printed cotton. It's sort of like a muslin fabric, very thin cotton fabric, that were wall hangings that are part of this as well. And one of them, I must say, was given to us by someone who bought it in a garage sale here about 15 years ago. So you never know where things are going to show up.
Bruce Pepich is the executive director and curator of collections at the Racine Art Museum. The exhibition of art from the Works Progress Administration will be on display through June 4th, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, we'll have our latest episode of Radio Chipstone, so stick around. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is Mother's Day weekend, time for afternoon brunches, a large spike in flower sales, and mom's stories about you as a child guaranteed to turn your embarrassment dial up to 11.
Well, 30 years ago, 16-year-old Liz Wormkrantz penned an epic letter to her mother, Ellen Wormkrantz. It was filled with teenaged angst. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Field shares both sides of that mother-daughter moment and learns that when it comes to honoring our mothers, one weekend may not be enough.
I have a 14-year-old daughter, and she's 14. So she's starting to get a little sassy. And my mom and I were talking about that a couple weeks ago. And then a couple days ago, she called me and said she found a couple letters that I had written her when I was a teenager. And she was like, I don't know if I should send them to you. They're pretty bad. And so I kind of had to work on her to get them. So she finally sent it to me. And I guess she kept them. There's a date on the top that's in her handwriting. So obviously when she got the letter, she knew to tuck it away and save it for later blackmail or embarrassment.
I don't remember exactly, but I think, first of all, I thought, well, someday I'm going to show this to her, and then she's going to see that I wasn't so bad as she thought I was, because when she has her children, she'll find out, you know, that it's not all happiness and whatever. Some of it I probably thought, was I really like that? Should I have done that? Maybe, you know what I mean? I was questioning myself too. So I think I was hurt a little bit from the letter when I first got it. And I just tucked it away. And here it is. I just found it 30 years later.
Mom, I'm writing this only because you don't seem to care enough to listen and try to understand the things I say to you. Maybe by having this in writing, you'll reread this and come to some conclusions that have been needed to be reached for quite some time. You need to come down off your pedestal and quit trying to prove to me again and again that you are the mother and have authority here. I know that. Don't fabricate things and expand the truth only to show me your power. That's pointless. It only makes me rebel.
She used to drive me crazy sometimes. Because when she was in eighth grade, you couldn't chew gum, but then they would have a gum day. So one day, they had a gum day, and it was right after Halloween, and I had gone out and bought a bag of 101 gumballs, because, of course, it was on sale. And so she decided she wanted to take the whole bag to school. And I said, no, you can't. What are you going to do with 101 gumballs? I knew trouble was lurking in the horizon if I let her do that. And she followed me around the house begging me to be able to take this bag of 101 gumballs. She followed me for 2 hours. I was on the phone and she kept saying, I have to take, if you don't understand, I have to give them to my friends. I have to do this, I have to do that. And I thought, I just can't back down. So I just held my ground, but she did this for like 2 hours. And finally, she just absolutely stopped asking because she knew I wouldn't, you know, go ahead and let her take 101 gumballs to school. So she was always doing a couple of crazy little things, you know, that I always had to watch out for her or whatever. But not that that has anything to do with the letter, but that's Liz.
Lately, I've come to know you as no more than a schizophrenic. One day you'll be great, a person I truly want to be with, and the next you'll be some power-hungry person looking to get me any way you can. You need to start being proud of me for the things I do accomplish instead of always overlooking that to be disappointed in the things I just missed. I am who I am, and you can't change that just by taking away my privileges after 6 p.m. Maybe that'll add to my knowledge and give me time to study, but it's taking away from our relationship. What it all comes down to is that you need to make a decision between our relationship or your quest for power. One must go.
Something must have happened right before it, and I must have said the 6 p.m. was probably just for that one infraction. I mean, I didn't make her stay in or not do anything after 6 p.m. her whole life. You know, I would do it for a couple weeks or something like that. So, I tried not to back down because I knew then I'd lose all my control if I had any.
If you ground me, I certainly won't be eager to please you. That's so far from it. You need to lower your expectations of me because obviously I'm not the person to fulfill them. I'm sorry I can't be and I won't be. As much as I love you, I won't totally alter myself and everything I've become just for you and just to fuel your desire to prove things to me. Just be my mom and my friend. Don't always make me feel like so much less of a person. Who cares if I want to talk on the phone? Who cares about a lousy C- in a very difficult course? That, when compared to a relationship that is slowly but surely crumbling between a mother and a daughter, doesn't seem as monumental now, does it?
I think she it was in March, and it was coming to the end of her senior year here in high school. She really thought that she was a grown-up at the end of her senior year because she was going to college, and she really, really resented that I could still have rules or whatever that she had to follow. And they weren't, I mean, you know, it was just, they weren't, I didn't make her stay in every night, you know, at 6 o'clock or anything like that. It was just normal kid rules, you know.
I'm sorry, but I don't feel like studying. I would have before, but I resent you now for making me feel like crap so much. I no longer wish to please you. This is my handwriting, it's a little crazy here too. I've ruled that out. Sorry I can't be the daughter you want and need. I'm sorry you can't take me and love me as I am. Think of how bad I could be, and then, once again, look at me with an open mind. And give me a chance to be myself, the person I want to be. That's all that matters in the end. Give me my freedom. I'm not a child, and you aren't God. Jeez. I may not always know what's best for myself, but I'll learn more learning things for myself and not following your book of rules for life. I need to be myself, not you.
I knew she wouldn't. She didn't mean what she said, you know, as a mother. I mean, I knew if she stopped and thought about it, because I was glad she could say whatever she wanted, and she did. And I knew she didn't, if she'd see what she actually wrote, she would realize she didn't really mean that at some point in her life. You know what I mean?
My mom's a wonderful person. Like, she's great. She's a great mom. She was a great mom. She is a great mom. And I know she did, you know, the best she can. And I had a great childhood. I love her. We have fun together. She's ridiculous. So, yeah.
Liz is a wonderful girl. She's a very likable person, I think. And she is very kind. And, you know, that's why I knew she would live to regret this letter. And she apologized to me for it, laughing, of course. But, you know, I have to keep reminding myself that she's 46 years old and that she has her own life. And she reminds me of that also, because I do try to tell her what to do, because a mother always thinks she has another chance to get her child on the right track. I think it's just a mother's. You want your child to do the best, and you want them to go in a certain way, and, you know, they go a different way, and so you're there to help them. Ha ha.
I have to be careful what I say, because my mother will probably hear this. I think partially, like, having read that and remembering how frustrated and mad I was, like, it's helpful to think, like, these little passionate outbursts of my kid, you know, they may seem over the top and ridiculous sometimes, but, like, they're coming from true feelings, and maybe just, like, trying to wade through the ridiculousness or the drama and get to the heart of what's wrong is a good idea. And I think I try to do that, but this kind of drove it home for me. So, and also just to kind of give her a break and not, like, come down on her every time she's a little bit snotty or dramatic. So far, my kid has not said many of those things to me. I mean, she has her moments, but I haven't gotten any letters.
Material Culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
We'll take one last break, and then Lake Effect Weekend returns with our storytelling series, Ex-Fabula. You're listening to us on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three. Two, one.
Welcome to Ex-Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex-Fabula!
Ex-Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is Ex-Fabula Radio Time, once again, part of Lake Effect Weekend on WUWM. I'm Bruce Winter with Ex-Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney, and we've been talking about this, all year. And it's finally almost here.
I know. All I want to keep doing is singing the Bugs Bunny theme song, that overture song, because we are here, folks, at our All-Stars event, Season 8 Story Slam Grand Finale.
It is finally here. Yeah, it seems like we've been talking about it since September of last year.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something to gear up for. And over the past few weeks, we've been featuring all of the Season 8 Story Slam audience favorites. Today is going to be the last two, the March and April favorites. And after that, we just head right over to Turner Hall Ballroom, May 18th. That's next week.
Yeah, Thursday.
Yeah. And everybody that won this season, all of those audience favorites, are going to get back up on stage at Turner Hall Ballroom, and they're going to tell a longer form story based on a completely different theme this time, which is unfinished business.
And as we have been listening over the past weeks, you can tell why these stories were the audience favorites for the night of the Story Slams, because these are good.
Most definitely. Yeah, I can't wait to see what's coming up on stage next week. You know, we've had a really incredible season, and, you know, we couldn't have done this work without our season sponsors. So again, three cheers to them as well. So let's march right into the stories with our March winner. Acquired taste was the theme for the night of that Story Slam. The audience favorite was Joel Dreising. So let's listen to Joel's story from Acquired Taste.
Scotch leaves a bad taste in my mouth. It's what my dad drank. It tastes like medicine, like topical medicine, not the kind that you put in your mouth, the kind you put on a carbuncle. As many times as I told my dad, as I declined scotch, my dad always invited me to join him for scotch. Scotch was just one of the things that my dad was always trying to share with me that I shunned. He was a good golfer. In the Depression, he was a caddy at a golf course, and he took whatever clubs he found in the lost and found, and he taught himself to golf, and he became an assistant pro. And he always wondered, he was always trying to get me to take up golf. That's where the deals are made, he'd say. That's where you can schmooze your boss. But I declined. I declined to take chemistry in high school just because Dad eventually became a chemist. He started working in the paper mill and got a job in the lab and eventually worked his way up to supervisor. And he couldn't understand why I didn't want to take chemistry, the central science. He just didn't understand that we didn't share the same tastes. He liked tinkering and gardening. I liked the Packers and TV. One of my first memories was crawling up on Dad's lap and wrapping my little arm around his neck and sharing hugs and kisses and I love yous. I had these plastic barrels. They were like Russian nesting dolls. And my dad was smoking after dinner one night, and he took one of the barrels and he blew some smoke in it and sealed the barrel up, and I ran with it into the kitchen where my mom was washing dishes, and I opened it up, and this big cloud of smoke came out, and my mom gasped, and she coughed, and I laughed. My dad stopped smoking after the Surgeon General said it wasn't good for your health. I can't remember when we stopped the kisses and the I love yous. As I got older, I involved myself in more extracurricular activities so that I'd have excuses to decline Dad's invitations to go fishing with him or to help him work on the car. He took a lot of pride in the car, and when I got old enough, he was always asking me if I wanted to take it, and I declined. I'd rather walk. One time he took me deer hunting with him. We got up real early in the morning and went to my Aunt Rosie's farm and got in the cold and in the dark and situated ourselves in a strategic spot. And my dad got all settled and his gun at the ready. And he looked at me and he said, "Wake me if you see anything." After a while, a deer approached, a buck, a big buck. It was awesome. Step by step, I watched it come closer, and I glanced at my dad, and he's still a snooze. The big buck came closer and closer, and Dad was snoring softly. When we got into the house for lunch, my cousin said, "Uncle Nubs, how come you didn't shoot at that big buck that we sent your way? Everybody saw it headed right toward you." And my dad looked at me, and I just shrugged. I wasn't a defiant kid or disrespectful or discourteous, but I know now that I was another obnoxious, obstinate adolescent. Over time and distance, I grew to appreciate my dad. He was a good guy. He was good to us seven kids. He loved our mom. He went out of his way for strangers. When he was young, he planted forests for the Civilian Conservation Corps, and he fought in the World War. In his retirement, he took meals to the homeless, and he built Habitats for Humanity. He served in the Honor Guard for countless numbers of veterans' funerals. And of course, by the time I recognized all that, I had already squandered all those chances to get to know him. I had already declined all those invitations to do things with him. And I know how much that would have meant to him then, and how much it would have meant to me now. And I don't put stock in regrets, because you can't change what's been. But I try to be a better son by trying to be a better father and a better husband and trying to be more like my dad. It was a few days after his birthday when I got a call that they were situating him into a hospice center and his heart stopped for good. And I got there and my sister Karen had a bottle of my dad's scotch and she poured me a glass and I drank to his life and his passing. And it's still hard to swallow.
And that was Joel Dreesing's audience favorite of the night from our Acquired Taste Story Slam. We're going to move right along, actually. Yeah. Let's just jump right into our next story. In April, we took the stage at 3041 North, which is a fantastic event space, where Peter May won the audience favorite for that night. That theme was really special because it was only in Milwaukee. So let's listen to Peter May's story.
In Milwaukee, especially on the South Side, if you got something you want to get rid of, but you don't want to throw it away, and it's too much trouble to sell, you put it out on the curb. Right? And that's the rule. You put it out there, it's free for the taking. So I drive to work one morning, and I pass this house, and there are six rocks sitting by the curb, along neatly by the curb, but actually arranged in order of size from the smallest to the largest. So, coincidentally, I have always wanted a rock garden. Okay, here's a fun fact. Granite weighs 208 pounds per cubic foot. I learned that later. So, I drive by each day, and the rocks are still there, the rocks are still there. And the tension is building because I want to get these sweet rocks before somebody else picks them up, you know? So that Saturday night, after Saturday Night Live and a bottle of Cabernet, I decide I'm going to go get those rocks. So I jump in my station wagon, drive over there, and attack the first rock. So you squat down, always lift with your legs, right? So I squat down, pick this thing up, get it up to, you know, the height of, you know, a deadlift, and then walk it over to my car and put it in the back of the station wagon. All right. Second rock, same thing. Squat, lift, waddle over to the car, put it in the back of the station wagon. By the third rock, I am sweating and straining. Let me give you a little insight about aging. I'm 63 years old. I can act 59 if I have to, but I'm 63 years old. But up here, I'm still 23, and I think no matter how old you get, you still got, you know. So this immature and difficult 23-year-old says, hey, you only got 3 of 6 rocks. You gotta get at least 4. Well, reason took over, and I decide, okay, I'm gonna drive back home, drop off the first 3 rocks, rest, and then I have a hand truck. I'm just going to go over there and walk the last rock back. So, 2 a.m. now. I'm at the curb, and here's my plan. You know, a hand truck, you got, you know. I decide what I'm going to do is tilt the blade up so that it's on the curb, and then I can just roll the rock onto the blade, right? So that's what I do. I start to roll the rock onto the blade. Now, I don't know what happened next, but this is my best guess. I think what happened is when the rock got over center, it fell forward and pushed the hand truck away a little bit. The hand truck started falling over, the rock hit the blade on the hand truck and stood it up violently. Now, head trauma would stop most guys. So, the next morning, Sunday morning, I wake up, I've got a lump on my head, and my wife wants to know why there are 4 rocks out in the driveway. And I explain the whole thing, out by the curb, there for the taking, anyone can have them, I always wanted a rock garden, you know, so I got these rocks, right? And she said, they're all lined up on the curb. And I said, yeah. She said, well, maybe they were just delivered. And I thought, that kind of makes sense. So I drive by this house all the time. So one time, there's a lady out working in the yard. And so I figure, you know, I got to ask. So, you know, excuse me, funny story, you know. Turns out Ruth was right. I had stolen this lady's rocks. So I apologized profusely. I offered to return them. She said, no, you know, I got them for free. And you know, I only really, the two I got will be enough for what. I'll have my son move them into the backyard, I guess to protect them from people like me, you know. So sure enough, next time I drive by, the two rocks are missing. And I really hope the son moved them to the back. And it wasn't just another Southsider who drove by and went, oh, free rocks. You know?
And that was the audience favorite from our April Story Slam, which was only in Milwaukee. That was Peter May telling us his story.
That is truly an only in Milwaukee thing, where if you just take something and leave it out at the curbside, the next morning it's gone. So it just disappears.
Yeah, you don't need like Craigslist or Facebook for that.
It's gone, yeah. Got this old television set, gone. So whatever.
Indeed. Yeah, you know what else is almost gone? Season 8.
Yeah. And
I can't believe it.
Let's remind everybody about the show coming up on Thursday.
Yeah, I will do that. It's going to be on Thursday, May 18th at Turner Hall Ballroom. It is our May All-Stars Grand Finale Story Slam of the Year. And you can get all information plus your tickets at xfabula.org. Oh, and I do want to add one more thing. If you, the listening audience, love Xfabula, have excellent event planning experience, we might have an opportunity just up your alley because we are hiring. You know, we're basically 99% all volunteer based here at Xfabula, but we are starting a new position. And you can find out all of the information on the event producer position at xfabula.org as well. And you can also apply there too. So if you are interested, please go there. Please go there for all Story Slam community-based things. We got you. We have it covered at xfabula.org.
And if you want to hear these stories again or share them, Xfabula Radio is at WUWM.com as well as on the air Saturdays and Sundays in this 3 o'clock hour. Leah, thank you. See you at the All-Star Show.
All righty.
Xfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4. Be sure to tune in to the weekday version of the show at 10 in the morning.
It is all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.